It's time to sit back, relax, and listen to Conversations with Joan. Conversations with Joan will inspire, motivate, and empower you. Live your best life now. Listen, learn, think, and decide. And now, here's your host, Joan Herman.
Welcome to Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life's Conversations with Joan. I'm Joan Herman. Thanks for tuning in. Conversations with Joan focuses on topics that are important to your life, from health and wellness to professional development to personal well-being. Change makers join me to share their insights, tips, and strategies so you can thrive and live your best life now. Thank you for taking time for yourself, and thank you for letting us be a part of your life. Now, let's start talking. Changes to your body and brain are normal as you age. And while it may feel like it's out of your control, research shows that there are things you can do to help slow any decline in memory and lower your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or other brain issues. Today's guest, Dr. Tommy Wood, joins us to discuss how you can improve focus and cognition at any age. Dr. Wood is an assistant professor of pediatrics and neuroscience at the University of Washington and the co-host of the Better Brain Fitness podcast. His forthcoming book is Future Proof Your Brain. Welcome, Dr. Wood. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
So, Doctor, when it comes to brain health, we often feel helpless, like it's something that's totally out of our control. But is it true that there's a lot we can do to promote and maintain a healthy brain?
Absolutely. I think one of the most pernicious issues with how we talk about our brains and how we think about our brains is that after maybe we get into our 20s or 30s, it's just this continuous decline in function where eventually maybe we end up with dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and there's nothing that we can do about it except for maybe make it worse, like not sleep well or have a few too many cocktails occasionally. But that's not true. So there's a huge amount of evidence that shows that if we stimulate our brains in particular, if we want to be good at a certain thing, just like our bodies, we can stimulate our brains with developing new skills, for instance, or learning new languages, new information. And then we provide the right kind of environment, the kind of things that help support the brain to adapt to those new challenges. The brain is able to respond and improve its function at pretty much any age.
Well, I think this is exciting because you're right. I mean, I remember growing up in school, we were taught that as you age, it deteriorates and there really isn't anything you can do about it. But this new research is very exciting. And so what are some of the ways then that we can create new neural pathways, and why would we even want to?
I think each of us wants to be independent and feel good and do the things that we enjoy throughout our entire lives. And for most of us, that's going to be at least 8 or 9 decades, maybe longer. And one of the most worrying things for a lot of people is that their brains will stop functioning to a point where they're not able to do those things. They're not able to look after themselves. And so that's why you might want to develop these new pathways or help promote your brain health. And when I think about how we do that, I have a model. You mentioned my podcast, the Better Brain Fitness podcast. I work with a neurologist, Dr. Josh Turknet, so we put some of these ideas together. And there are three main buckets that you can think about in terms of brain health. So I mentioned at the beginning that challenging the brain, learning new skills, doing new movements, new languages, social connection is another critical component. These things challenge the brain in a good way, just like exercise challenges our body. We need to challenge our brain for it to adapt. It's exactly the same as, you know, when we're exercising for better physical health. So anything that challenges the brain in that way, that's our main first bucket. That's the way that we drive changes in the brain. Then to respond to those changes, we need some other things to be present. So we need nutrients, which can come from the diet. These help the cells make new connections. So certain fats in the diet, like omega-3s, certain vitamins are very important for this process. We also need healthy vascular function. We need our heart and our blood vessels to deliver oxygen and nutrients and those things to the brain. And there's this adage that what's good for the heart is good for the brain. And that's generally true for that reason. And then the final bucket is needing some period for these adaptations and improvements to occur. And so that's when sleep is critically important. That's when this happens. And alongside that, we need to make sure we're not doing things that might inhibit that process or prevent our brains from adapting to these new challenges. And so that's things like making sure we're not smoking too much or drinking too much. Some of these things can then inhibit the brain's ability to respond to those challenges. So those are the three main buckets, and each is going to be different for a different person, but it allows people to think about, you know, where's going to be the biggest bang for my buck if I'm going to invest in my own personal long-term brain health.
This new understanding, the research that you spoke about, how is that going to impact the way we manage Alzheimer's or dementia? Will it impact the way it's treated? And will it one day, do you think, be even possible to reverse the damage from those diseases?
The first thing that I think will hopefully come into practice, and it's now in position statements from the American Academy of Neurology, which is that we can prevent some of these diseases. So it's been estimated by several groups around the world that at least 40% of dementia is preventable with lifestyle and the environment and some of these things I've already mentioned. Others think it may be even more than that, maybe up to 75% is preventable. And so that's where, you know, we're going to get the biggest impact, is if we focus on these things before brain function starts to really deteriorate. However, there are several small groups who have been putting some of these things into practice in clinical trials where they combine multiple things that can improve brain health. So some kind of cognitive training, some physical activity, some dietary improvements in individuals who are older or already either at risk for cognitive decline or experiencing some cognitive decline. And they're seeing either slowing of the cognitive decline or improvements in cognitive function, even in people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. So this is being done right now, you know, very small studies to start with, but people are putting this into practice and we're starting to see some benefits there.
So doctor, the field of epigenetics tells us that, you know, lifestyle has a major factor in the way that genes express and in the types of diseases that we may get, that our genes are not necessarily our destiny. But when it comes to brain health, how important are your genes in determining whether or not you will have an issue down the road?
Overall, they're not very important at all. That's not to say that there aren't genes that are important. And there are a few that people may have heard of. First, it's worth separating out two broad categories of Alzheimer's disease. That's the sort of the main form of dementia that we're talking about, and that's the most common form of dementia. So the first type is related, and this is what affects most people, maybe 99% cases of Alzheimer's, is this type that we talked about that's largely or thought to be largely preventable. The other type is early onset Alzheimer's disease, which is caused by single mutations in genes that result in much earlier deterioration in cognitive function. And that's why this early onset Alzheimer's disease can affect people in their 30s and 40s. That is definitely genetic. However, the other 99% appears to be almost entirely driven by the environment. There are some genes like the APO E gene, which people may have heard of. And if you have one or two copies of the APOE4 gene, this is associated with a significantly increased risk in Alzheimer's disease. However, your APOE gene maybe affects around 5% of your overall risk of Alzheimer's. So it does affect your risk, but it's a very small component. And most people who have Alzheimer's disease don't have this gene. And not everybody who has this gene gets Alzheimer's disease. And there's a lot of evidence from populations around the world that this gene doesn't necessarily mean that you have an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. It seems like there's an interaction between this gene and the environmental factors that we talked about. So even if you are at risk because of your genetics, if you focus on the lifestyle and the environmental components, that may completely eliminate or at least dramatically reduce the effect of genetics. So really the vast majority of your risk is determined by lifestyle and the environment.
Doctor, I'm sure you've heard people making the jokes, and I'm guilty of doing this as well, that, you know, I can forget what I'm saying while I'm saying it, or I walk in a room and I can't remember why I went in the room. When should we be worried about that? And how much of that do you think is part of aging? And how much of it do you think is the overstimulation of our brain today that it never shuts off with all the technology?
That's a fantastic question. And in reality, these small lapses in what we call memory retrieval are incredibly common. And so, again, it's worth separating out some of these processes here. When you make a memory, you first have to encode it, which basically means that you have to create it and store it in your brain. This is a process that is lost in Alzheimer's disease and dementia. It's an issue with encoding the memory in the first place, not an issue with retrieving the memory. So most of us, when we have these slip-ups, we can't quite remember something, it's on the tip of our tongue, we can't remember where we left our keys. These are generally issues with memory retrieval, and they are much more common when we are stressed, when we are sleep deprived, and when we have a high cognitive load. And so that can be from lots of things that we're thinking about, people trying to talk to us, social media, this hyper-stimulated environment that you mentioned. That's what really seems to be underlying those sort of moments when we can't quite grasp the thing in our memory that we want to grasp. So the positive bit of that is that it's probably not an onset of a more serious cognitive decline. But we do also know that if we're stressed and sleep deprived, that can contribute to long-term cognitive decline. So in the moment, it's not necessarily an issue. But if those things continue long-term, then there's a possibility it may become problematic.
Well, and what you describe, that's the way we all live our lives, stressed, sleep-deprived, and overstimulated. So, of course, it's
Absolutely.
Going to cause problems. But, you know, is a good trick to try to have memory recall, is it to try to attach an emotion to something?
One major difference about the older brain compared to the younger brain is there's more inertia in terms of developing new memories and new skills. So people often think that, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. You know, I'm just too old to learn a new language or a new physical activity or anything like that. That's absolutely not true. However, your brain's current state and its current function is the result of however many decades you've lived this far, and your brain has been adapting to you and your environment and your life that entire time. So you don't want that to suddenly change, because you want your brain to be adapted to who you are and the life that you live. So you need to give your brain a reason to change or a reason to make these new memories. So you mentioned emotion, and that's one way to do it. But the primary thing we have to do is, if we really want to remember something, is we have to provide some kind of focus and stimulus in order to remember that. So if you drop your keys somewhere different every day and you never really think about it, the brain isn't really designed to remember that every day, because you haven't really told your brain that it's important to remember that. But if you there's something that you really want to remember, creating a period of focus and really telling your brain this is important, and that can be with emotion. And often when we're learning new skills, it comes with frustration. And actually that process of frustration drives these changes in the brain. It's part of telling the brain, this is important, I want to be good at this in the future. So it's mainly worth remembering that if we want our brains to change, and they can change, we need to give a good reason for that and actually focus on that process.
And Doctor, my work is around change your attitude, change your life, and the importance of what we think and how that impacts our overall health and well-being. Would you speak to our listeners and explain to them the science behind that? Why our thoughts impact our physical and emotional health?
This is a fascinating field that has really come to the forefront in the last maybe 10 years or so. And it's related to many of the things we've already talked about, the importance of social connection, some of the detrimental effects of social media, where we're constantly comparing ourselves to others. We're creating this social rank, usually by lowering how we see ourselves relatively to other people in the world. And when this happens, and it's the same thing that happens when we're socially isolated, for example, which is an increasing problem in the way modern societies are structured, this creates this change in first our thoughts, like you said, but it also changes our immune systems and our nervous system. And this is an evolutionary conserved process. This is important. So imagine that you were socially isolated thousands of years ago. You needed to be able to deal with a different set of threats from what you were maybe dealing with otherwise. So if you're living in a large group, we know that it's very common that you might get a viral infection, right? These kind of respiratory viruses that go around, flus and colds. We need to be able to better defend against these. And so our immune system is set up for that when we're socially connected. When we're socially isolated, we shift our immune system to better deal with things like acute injuries. So we get better wound healing if, you know, we fall and hurt ourselves, which is maybe more likely if we're alone. However, when we upregulate those processes chronically, these lead to higher levels of inflammation, higher levels of activation of the sympathetic nervous system, which is the one associated with stress, the fight or flight response. And then those can contribute to long-term changes in health and an increased risk of long-term disease. So this is a very long way of saying that how we think and how we think about ourselves, this directly changes our immune system and our nervous system, and long-term can contribute to increased risk of chronic disease.
And it goes back to what you described before, the way we're living our lives. We're stressed, we're sleep deprived, we're negative, we're overstimulated. Mm. And all of those things are breaking down, you said, our heart, our brain, our immune system. We really have to take a look at the way we live our lives. And, you know, and I talk to so many doctors like you, and I have the benefit of hearing what you all say. And you all offer the same advice, no matter if I'm speaking with a cardiologist or a neurologist, you're all saying the same thing. And, you know, it's just a general practice to look at our life and make some hard changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are these core main things that we need in order to be healthy, and they affect all of our, all of the systems and organs in the body. And another thing that we've been thinking about more, you know, in our medical fields over the past, you know, 10 years or so, is that all these organs and systems are directly connected, right? So you just mentioned that your thoughts actually become changes in your physiology throughout your body. And so these core, the same core principles, sleep, diet, social connection, physical activity, these are the things that are almost encoded in our physiology. It's required for us to be healthy. And so you're right. People will give the same advice regardless of which organ in the body you're talking about, because it's so important for all of them and how they're connected. And it's not particularly new or sexy, but these are the real things that we need in order to be healthy long term.
And Dr. Wood, where can our listeners go to get more information about you and your work?
I have a website, drtommywood.com. I'm on Instagram at Dr. Tommy Wood, and the podcast that you mentioned, the Better Brain Fitness podcast, it's the question and answer style podcast that people can submit questions online, either recorded as voice questions or written questions. And then myself and Josh will answer them as best we can. So if there's any follow-up questions from our interview today, that's a great place to go, because then we can give the answer to your question to everybody who listens to the podcast.
And in about 30 seconds or less, what's a takeaway?
There are three main areas that determine our long-term brain health. The most important one is how we challenge and use our brains throughout our lives. Then that process of challenging our brains is supported by making sure that we eat a healthy diet and we are physically fit, because these then support that adaptation. And then we need some period of time for that adaptation to occur, which is where sleep is really critical. And we need to make sure we're not inhibiting that by drinking too much or being chronically stressed that can prevent that from happening. But if you address all of those areas, that can dramatically increase your long-term cognitive function.
Dr. Wood, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you found the show informative. At at Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life, we believe that knowledge is power. Take what you've learned, apply it, and live your best life now. Remember that the information provided is the opinion of our guest and should never replace the advice of a professional who knows your personal situation. If you'd like more information, visit our website, CYL.com. That stands for Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life. While on our site, listen to past shows on demand, read the digital magazine, sign up for our mailing list, and be sure to follow the show on social media. Until next time, this is Joan Herman. Thanks for tuning in.